Welcome to our Federal Drive discussion. I'm Tom Temin.
I'm Emily Kopp. This hour, we'll speak with Jack London, chairman of the board of CACI International and the author of Character, the Ultimate Success Factor. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
All right, so you have written a book about character. It's called Character, the Ultimate Success Factor. Tell us why that topic was the selection for such a big undertaking.
Well, that's a perfectly fine question to get us started. I'll tell you that I didn't start out with the title already in place, but I did several years ago, about 3.5 years ago, start into looking at the issue of how effective integrity, what was happening in our market space in particular. And the book was really, I positioned the book to be mostly something that I could put with my employees, frankly. The idea was to set a standard and begin to think in terms of how to communicate the importance of character, integrity, ethics, and so on. We've worked at CACI for many decades on the issue of trying to establish a image and reputation for our character and our ethics and our business activities. So the reason that book took on the character that it has and the title it has is mostly an evolutionary kind of a thing over the last many years, but certainly this last 3.5 years that I worked on the book. I think that the idea of character itself is something that's very important today. In fact, the United States Naval Academy, I'm a graduate, in its Shipmate magazine, this last January and February edition, published a lead article, "The Crisis of Character." So I think the timeliness of the coincidence, if you will, in some ways, my title of my book is really right spot on for what's happening in our social system and our government and our military and so many dimensions of our life today. So it's one of those things that sort of came together.
You've hired a lot of people at CACI over the years. And just wondering, how do you assess someone's character, for example, a job candidate?
Well, of course, there's no magic formula here, but you certainly could do discussions and have a number of interviews and meet people, and I think you get a pretty good feel for their background and their integrity. I will tell you this. What I have learned and discovered over the years about the behavior of people and their attitudes and their views of doing the right thing, that once you get a group of people that have this threshold and standard, they tend to want to work with people of the same belief and same values. And what happens is it becomes a little bit of a snowball kind of a thing. It has its own momentum that people that are interested in behaving in what I'll call a straightforward, do-the-right-thing approach tend to attract others. And quite frankly, it works just the other way around, that those that aren't comfortable with that standard and that threshold tend to find ways to be on their way elsewhere. So you do have a certain momentum that gets moving on this, and I'm kind of remarkable in a way if you think about how that works, and you probably have seen it in your own lives and careers. People tend to share values, and they tend to join together. So that's really a lot of what's going on in our recruiting process.
So how does a big institution like the Navy, and I know that's a beloved institution to you and really in some ways to the whole country, how does it make sure that if it sees a crisis in character, that it gets the whole thing turned around the other way?
The larger the organization, the more challenging, obviously, for the notion of having a character, the organizational character. By the way, in my book, I really address both aspects of what I call individual character attributes and to some extent, lesser extent, but to some extent, organizational character itself, which is really an accumulation in some, it's a synthesis, if you will, of the characters of the individuals. With regard to an institution like the United States Navy, there is a certain amount of image, reputation that can be propelled or perpetuated by leadership. And I would say it all boils down to really to leadership and the commitment of leaders. We've seen that in the creation of CACI's lifestyle values over the years. It's really a leadership issue. And by the way, it's not a one-time policy development. It's not a one-time memo or email out to everybody that we're going to have a good character. It is something that has to be sustained. One, an anecdote that's kind of interesting or a perspective is talking about character is a lot of like trying to give a speech to a passing parade. You have to repeat yourself and fairly frequently because nobody's going to be listening to you and they're going to be passing through. So that's certainly true of the military services and really any large organization. It's something that has to be sustained by leadership. And I think you'll find that the United States Navy has done a good job in that regard over the decades and centuries for that matter of fact. But we're having some difficulties right now. In some ways, that probably reflects what's happening in our society, because in many regards, the military services are represent a cross section of our society. One example that I will point out with regard to the military is the United States Marine Corps. It is, I think, in a singular fashion, quite renowned for its image and reputation and its character. There is a concept in the Marine Corps called Mission, Values, and Pride, MVP. And that's taught to every recruit in basic camp, a boot camp. And the idea is you start with with new people coming into the organization, you set the standards with them, and then they will be progressing as they go along and share those values. And that's the trick, where you get to a point where people, from an institutional basis, share those values.
Let's look at the other side. I mean, if you think about the military, some of the character problems that's had, one of the biggest and most recent is the sexual assault scandals. Mm-hmm. Seems like they've gotten off track. How do they get back on track when you're talking about things like character, and it's not readily apparent?
That's interesting you mentioned that one, because I reflect back last year when the Joint Chiefs were on Capitol Hill and testifying in front of Congress. And I watched that on C-SPAN and with a certain degree of sadness, frankly. I know Admiral Greenert, the CNO, and I know also General Amos and, to a lesser extent, General Ordiano. And I also know Admiral Papp. So these are people that I know personally. And I could see the angst and anguish on their faces as they were contending with these issues and the questions, the probing. And it is a tragedy, in my opinion, of the first order. And certainly it's going to take a lot of command attention. But again, it goes back to this issue of standards, setting the thresholds of behavior. And quite frankly, they have to be adhered to. And if you get into situations, for example, where there's some kind of acquiescing or sweeping things, so to speak, under the rug, which does happen in any institution, you'll see those kinds of behaviors. So there's a need for focus, in my opinion, and continued training and making sure that you communicate the standards, and the standards will be observed, and the deviations from those standards are going to have serious consequences. That has to be a clear message. It has to be repeated. Again, it's that passing parade issue. If you want one memo, one policy document, one set of training courses won't do it. It's going to have to take a sustained, continuing, persistent effort on the part of leadership, in my opinion.
Now, your book is several hundred pages filled with anecdotes of people that showed really great character in tough situations. Give us one of your favorite examples.
Well, I have a number. They come in different kinds. I'll pick on one that has to do with industry, and that is the Iacocca story, how he faced a very challenging situation, stood up to the issues, and what was the character issue regarding that for him?
You say you're going to have to remind some of the younger folks listening about who Lee Iacocca was.
Okay, Lee Iacocca was the CEO of Chrysler. He had been at Ford Motor Company and very successful, but he and Henry Ford had a falling out. So he went over to Chrysler, and they were in great financial difficulties. And, in fact, they were essentially going bankrupt.
GM isn't the first car company bailed out.
As a matter of fact, I guess Chrysler was the first one that was successful with the government support. But what the thing that Iacocca stood out for was facing the music, making the tough decisions, standing up and calling for the right kinds of actions to preserve the great institution of Chrysler Motor Company. Now, he got a lot of help doing it, but his leadership there and his standing out and standing up for what needed to be done took a lot of pizzazz, if you will, and so I thought that was a good one. I did have the opportunity to meet him just after he was successful with the Chrysler. He became the chairman on the Statue of Liberty campaign, and I had the good fortune to attend a fundraising event down at one of the hotels in town. And after it was over, I went up and introduced myself to him and told him a little bit about my situation. And I was in a company that was endeavoring to go through a turnaround as well. And that got his attention. And frankly, it was a lot of fun. He pulled me over to the side. We had a conversation for about 5 or 10 minutes and about things, and said, asked me some questions. It was a real fun experience. And it was interesting how he jumped on the idea of a smaller company faced with similar issues of trying to get things turned around. And I put his experiences in my book as well.
You're listening to a special Federal Drive discussion with CACI Chairman Jack London and author of Character, The Ultimate Success Factor. Coming up next, we'll talk about the lessons for crisis management and reputational protection. I'm Tom Temin, along with Emily Kopp. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to our Federal Drive discussion with Jack London, chairman of CACI International and author of Character, The Ultimate Success Factor. I'm Emily Kopp.
And I'm Tom Temin. I guess let's start with one of the biggest crises that your company has faced, Jack, and that is the idea of Abu Ghraib and the scandal surrounding that early on in the Iraq War. And there was the torture allegations, and the company got caught up in that. Just recount for us what happened and how you got around all of that.
Well, the Abu Ghraib prison just outside of Baghdad was a place that the United States Army brought together detainees, a whole many detainees. In fact, it was, you might say, an overflow situation. And CACI went under contract to support the United States Army in interrogation and data collection, data analysis, intelligence data analysis. And we'd been in the intelligence community work for many years, and this was a bit of a specific dimension to that work. And what happened at Abu Ghraib was there was a whole series of, in the fall of 2003, of abuses that were perpetrated. And these events became a national sensation or scandal, I should say, in 2004. In fact, it was in April 2004 that the New Yorker magazine published an article in that 60 Minutes, too, had a night show about and showed a lot of those infamous, notorious pictures. And so CACI was accused in one of the military preliminary, illegally leaked military report, an Article 15.6 UCMJ report, was accused of one of our interrogators was accused of some abuses. And so what basically happened was that this all became public, as I just said, in April. And we took a position. We were approached, obviously, by the media asking us questions, what was going on, and so on. So we took an in-depth investigation to discover through a third-party investigative effort. And the findings, preliminary and otherwise, within a few weeks, were that these charges really were not well-founded. We didn't know in a proof, beyond a doubt phase, but we had no indications of any wrongdoing. For example, a couple of people that were mentioned in the report that were supposed to be our employees weren't our employees. Also, none of our people were seen in the photographs. Our people were not on duty when these things were being these abuses that you saw in the photographs were being perpetrated. And so what basically happened was we recognized, and I recognized soon, that this was going to be a major scandal, if you will, great crisis really for our country.
The scandal can get all the way around the world before the truth gets its boots on.
Yeah, it gets out of bed. Yeah, right. And I think he's quite correct about that, especially in the day of the internet and all. But so our posture was simply we're going to do the right thing. And that's we were going to do the right thing by our employees, by our customers, and whatever was necessary to literally do the right thing in this situation. We found out, as I just indicated, that we had no body that was demonstrated to have perpetrated any of these things. So we didn't want to. There were a lot of calls to fire our employees over there, and I was very concerned about it. There were no facts that showed that they were guilty of anything, and I was very concerned about firing a bunch of people and how that would go through my my workforce. That the executive of the company, CEO, was running around firing people because somebody in the media said to do so, without facts to support that. And so we had a little bit of a contention about those issues in a public way. We also, of course, stood up with the United States Army and other investigators, 9 different investigations, by the way, that summer that looked into CACI. our involvement, and we were not really accused in any way of any what I would call significant issues. There were some contract snarls and so forth that could have been done better, but there was nothing that that rose to the level that were the accusations of those heinous abuses and a god-awful situation. And of course, as most of people may know, that those abuses really, unfortunately, boiled down to half a dozen or a dozen or so Army people, regrettably. But we have had some lawsuits that have been pursuing the civil suits. We were never charged anything, no charges whatsoever by the United States government, the United States Army, or anybody else. And by the way, it occurs to me more than once that if the United States government or Army felt that we had done anything wrong, I don't think they would hesitate in filing charges. So that almost, in a way, sort of speaks for itself. But there have been some civil accusations and lawsuits from individuals on these issues, and we have persistently rejected those accusations.
Well, let me ask you to extrapolate from your experience, and this is still ongoing. There are some who are on behalf of detainees wanting to reinstate lawsuits against the company. But when you look at, for example, the General Services Administration and how it dealt with this Las Vegas conference spending spree a couple of years ago, or how the administration has dealt with the rollout of healthcare.gov, what are some of the lessons that you learned through your crisis with the Abu Ghraib scandal that you think can apply to government agencies facing these other types of scandals?
Well, I rest on what I've advocated and tried to pursue myself. Not always with 100% success. I know none of us are perfect, but you just simply have to stand up and take accountability. In fact, that's really what a character is all about, is the individual fortitude, if you will, especially under stressful situations. There's this old issue about you can have good character when there's no challenges and no issue involved at all. It's when things really get tough. So my suggestions and recommendations would be simply to research the facts, and that's important to get the facts, but to publicly, in a very prompt way, establish with the American people, with our citizenry, that we will do the right thing, whatever that may turn out to be, that the leadership of the organization, whatever it may be, what department of the government and so on, will take a posture of we want to be known as an organization that will do the right thing. And we'll have to maybe in some ways let the chips fall where they may. But that also begs the issue, doesn't it, about leadership in the first place, having to set the thresholds and the standards and to comport themselves in a fashion that is responsible and retains the trust of the American people. If you look at some of the polls these days about the American people, how they view Congress, how they view the administration, how they view industry, how they view commerce and banking industry and so forth, it's very low ratings, generally speaking. I lament that. I think that's a very sad thing, because what it really means is the American people in so many ways have lost trust in their leadership in these institutions. I don't think that's a good sign. That's another reason I think that what we're trying to do, and by the way, I have a call to action in this book, and that is to communicate the notion among our citizenry and among our leadership that these things really do matter. They're not just ivory tower academic things. They're issues that need to be fostered, promoted, and leadership through example is very important. So,
what about saying I'm sorry? Because that seems to be something that either people say a lot, but not necessarily with the action behind it, or on the reverse, tend to say mistakes were made.
Well, I for one believe in apology. If it's sincere, if it's a learning experience for us, I don't believe in lip service of any sort, including the lip service that character is important. I think there has to be sincerity and meaning and gravitas associated with these matters. On the other hand, we're not perfect, and in my material here, I don't want to, for a second, to come off as self-righteous or holier than thou or somehow ivory tower here. What we really need to get to is a very practical implementation here, which I think would address some of the aspects of your question, is how do we do it, and where we're raising the standards and the thresholds of our accountability, of our integrity and our ethics and our dealings and our trust with one another. I'll give you one quick one. When I was raised in Oklahoma City in the 40s and 50s, I remember being able to walk all the way to school, 6, 8, 10 blocks away, or ride my bike, and I was a kid, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old. And I would come home in the afternoon. My mother and father worked, and we never locked the door. I could go in. And then later on in life, I remember my father, I was a small business proprietor in Oklahoma City, and I remember him making deals with his vendors with a handshake. They'd followed up with a letter, but there was a handshake. They trusted each other. And in our social system, unfortunately, a lot of that no longer exists, and I lament that. But it's getting back to this idea, getting back to the idea of the American people being able to trust their leadership in these positions, I think is what we want to try to move toward.
And just briefly, so what are some concrete things, two or three, that a company can do? And you might have had stockholders clamoring also, just to make sure that reputation is maintained, even though it deservedly should be. But as you say, the trial by media can damage it anyhow.
It's a never-ending challenge. I think credibility, and when you present a course of action that you're faithful to it, that you're able to implement, that you, if you're not able to implement, you promptly advise the parties involved so that this is your credibility issue.
So it's your actions.
So it's behavior, actions, public statements, of course. And I think that the dialogue with the public is an extremely important part of what you're saying here. Again, it all boils down to accountability and leadership and being able to stand up and be responsible for your actions and your and what you plan and how you develop those plans and how you implement them.
You're listening to a special Federal Drive discussion with Jack London. He is chairman of CACI International and author of Character, the Ultimate Success Factor. Coming up next, we're going to talk about federal procurement and how it's evolved over the years. I'm Emily Kopp.
And I'm Tom Temin. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to our Federal Drive discussion. We're joined by Jack London, the chairman of CACI International and author of Character, the Ultimate Success Factor. I'm Emily Kopp, along with Tom Temin. And Jack, we want to talk to you a little bit about procurement. It's a big topic, of course, in the federal market. Do you think it's getting better or just morphing?
Well, I'd hope it's getting better. It is a challenging arena. I'll answer your question from a little bit different perspective. I early in my career, did not appreciate the value associated with competition. And maybe that's because I was a little small company and I couldn't compete against the big guys in the world and so forth. As I've matured and learned more about what makes an organization successful and what really makes our country successful is the concept of competition. I'm talking about appropriate, proper, dignified type of competition. I'm not talking about backstabbing, that sort of thing. But I think what the great value of the competitive arena is you get innovation, you get creativity, you get the best possible perspectives and services and products. So I'm all for it. In fact, I like it because it keeps us on our toes. It keeps us out in front, creating, inventing, innovating, being the entrepreneurs that are necessary to create the kind of enterprise that we operate. And we're in the infotech world and the networks and communications and all the rest of it and the intel side. So we've got to really be out with new ideas and creating solutions that have high value. So in the procurement side of things, clearly there's let me back off another time. I've been in this business going on 42 years now. And I've seen cycles, several cycles of competitive positions, different kinds of procurement methods and criteria and so forth. The big issue today is the stress on the funding money side. And that is going to drive a different kind of competition, I suspect. But the most important thing in some ways is that the missions that we serve, in particular my company is a heavy concentrated work with the Department of Defense and the military services and the intelligence community, is that their needs and requirements are just as acute and important as ever, and the availability of resources to support those apparently is going to be suppressed or pushed back. So that's up to industry and the government to come up with creative ways in their procurement processes and their selection criteria and so on, and industry to be to put its thinking cap on yet again. To come up with methods and approaches that will meet the needs of our great nation. And it's really a challenge, but I think we're up to it.
And you mentioned how long you have been doing this so that you are aware that there's been eras in federal contracting. There was the Brooks era, then the Competition and Contracting Act came along. There's been a lot of ceaseless innovation, if you will, in the whole system. Then we had the Clinger-Cohen Act, and now we have the, who knows, FITARA might take us into another era. So that's, so the question is it really getting better, you know, this situation, or is it just getting more process oriented and the government still makes the same mistakes over and over?
Wow. I'm glad you mentioned the Competition Contracting Act of 1984. When I first saw that, I thought somebody was playing a joke on me and had an anagram of my name, CACI, CICA, Contract and Competition
Sure.
Act. And I couldn't believe it at first. And it's still kind of a humorous anecdote that I share once in a while, like now. I think process has a lot to do with this. I also think that procurement and contracting expertise is not something that you can pick up a textbook and learn how to do it, you know, in a month's time. So the standards and quality of the United States government's contracting organization has waxed and waned depending on budgets and cutbacks and so forth. And anytime you begin to decimate, if you will, or suppress or cut back that cadre of expertise, you're going to have challenging kinds of things that will happen. I think that's pretty well an agreed upon fact. So often what we have tried to do over the years is put process in place of experience. And that's difficult to do. That is really difficult to do because the great value, I have looked back in my career, the procurements we pursued and the where I thought deals came out really well for the government, whether we won or not, where the experience was clear. In the requirements and the specifications, putting the packages together where the offers had good knowledge of what was really being sought.
And so the corollary question is, can, when the vendors are really experienced, the bidders, the offerers, and you've got somebody on the government side that maybe doesn't know so many of the tricks and subtle things that don't come out in the textbook, could that give industry sometimes an advantage over the government? And I guess vice versa, if you've got a really experienced contracting officer and a neophyte who has every good intention trying to compete newly in the federal market, they could be a little bit maybe bamboozled by the government.
Well, I'm sure that those kinds of things take place. Again, I back off on this from a character perspective. I believe in dealing in good faith and representations and I'm not one that believes in these gimmicky kind of things or tricks. I think that they come back on you, and frankly, I don't want to be known as a trickster, and I don't want CACI International to be known as a tricky outfit. We operate in good faith. That's our mission and our approach to the business market space, and we will deal straight up in that and be competitive in that vein.
The government, of course, is the legislative branch and the executive branch, primarily when we're talking about procurement. Taken together, do you think that they do enough to foster healthy competition of the type that you've described among industry?
I think it's do a fine job of it. I would give them good marks, by and large.
And why?
It's a lot. Well, it's like anything, there are always exceptions. Just my observation of many years' experience, I think I typically feel when I look at the won and lost column from my perspective, I pretty much think that it's turned out the way it should. there are times when we've sort of pushed the edge and maybe got a little bit over our head or whatever, and it usually winds up to sort itself out. So I'd give the process writ large good marks. Now there's a lot of improvements that can be made, but I think overall I'm talking about over a number of years now. I'm not talking about the last 6 months. But I think that the process works pretty well. I'd give it pretty good marks, actually.
And the United States federal government has a pretty good reputation, at least in terms of the low occurrence of public corruption. I mean, fundamentally, from what I've been able to discern over the 20-some years I've been following the federal government in particular, it does seem basically honest. And that's why when the instances of dishonesty come out, it's so surprising. Is that your perspective, that fundamentally?
I think that's true, yeah.
That it's that way?
Yeah. It's the exceptions, though, that hurt. You know, it's think of it as a dramatic example of exceptions. Aldridge Ames, the CIA spy, or Robert Hansen, the FBI spy. It's the exceptions, the dramatic exceptions that really caused the consternation and, frankly, tarnished the reputation.
By the way, there's another book out also, coincident with yours, coming out about character, about the Aldrich Ames incident, and it's called Circle of Treason, which is not a, you know, not the kind of title I think you'd want to write a book about.
Well, that's published by the Naval Institute, United States Navy, and I happen to be on still serving on the board of directors over there. So we're very proud of that book that's been out here recently, and it's a good one, too.
You're listening to a special Federal Drive discussion with Jack London, chairman of CACI International and author of Character, The Ultimate Success Factor. Coming up next, we'll dive deep into character and how to infuse it in an organization. I'm Tom Temin, along with Emily Kopp, Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to our Federal Drive discussion with Jack London, the chairman of the board of CACI International and author of Character, The Ultimate Success Factor. I'm Tom Temin, along with Emily Kopp. And to finish out this interview this morning, we wanted to ask you to return to the main topic, which is character, and especially character in an organization. And, of course, you've been at CACI a long time, rising from recruit, basically, to chairman of the board, and you had a lot of operational experience along the way. Just review for us again how leadership makes sure that character does happen.
We have been pursuing the notion of corporate integrity and ethical standards for decades. And this was part of the values of the organization when I joined. If you're in the software business, you quickly learn you have to trust people and what they tell you about how they're progressing and building their packages. I quickly learned that I had to rely on people of integrity and of good faith and that would share with me their problems when they had them in terms of the delivery of our products. So we have been working, needless to say, on the concept of character and integrity for many decades. And Tom, it's a what you are endeavoring to do is make it part of your culture. It's the culture that you create that embraces the notion of doing the right thing. Again, this is not a holier-than-thou, this is not everybody's perfect kind of an issue. This is a practical application of good faith, of trying to do and behave in a fashion that suits the best interests of the organization and the parties involved. And the only way you maintain a culture over decades is have it be a high priority. This can't be something, a back-office issue. This has to be an out-front, topical issue that's sustained over a period of time. It's not a one memo deal, as I've indicated, or one email message to the group. And I think that's the big difference between creating a organization that has a sustained culture and one that has difficulties like the Enron or the WorldComs, where the leadership clearly did not embrace the notion of doing the right thing. And that became a cultural problem for them.
So in your book, you delineate these aspects of character and what makes a good leader and a good leader in terms of character. When you look at this world of federal vendors and agencies, which aspect do you think needs the most help?
I'll quickly say I'm not sure, but I do believe that we need to share this as a goal in our industry. That and I mentioned earlier that I'm in the process with my book as a call to action among the parties of our industry, and I'm engaging in a number of interviews, talks, speeches, book signings, and so forth, where I'm calling on people to let's get back to setting the standards and recreating the thresholds if necessary. What I'd like to do in so many ways is to have CACI be a leader in this regard, a thought leader and an inspirational leader, and to be a role model, in effect, within this industry. And again, I want to hasten to say that this is not we realize that the world isn't perfect. There are people that do things that are improper and illegal, but organizations can have the character of addressing those issues, just like we did and the posture we took with the board support and I took back in the Abu Ghraib days. You know, it was a bad thing that apparently it happened, but it turned out, of course, not to be the case. But standing up and addressing it at the right time and doing so in a very forthright way, I think, set a standard. And we're very proud of how we went through that. And I think those kinds of situations and circumstances will arise for other organizations and how they respond to them and addressing all of this from a standpoint of doing the right thing. The famous Johnson & Johnson case, the Tylenol, is one I write up in my book about the poison problem back in the early 80s and the deaths that...
contamination by someone
or
something.
Yes, terrible thing. Anonymous contaminants, poison, and so forth kill people. The CEO of Johnson & Johnson basically stood up as part of their ethos, part of their culture, and said, we're going to do the right thing by the community, by the people that wind up our patients and so on. And that it was a role model, by the way, that I pursued back during even the Abu Ghraib time, was reflecting on how do you cope with these things? So I would recommend those kinds of approaches and those examples to the industry. And in this day, there's a lot of stress because of the budget situations, and probably temptations will be out there. So this is a time for reinforcing the notion of integrity and character and standing up and doing the right thing.
Now, you mentioned also something I think that throughout the book that's worth noting here. And we live in an age where T-ball, they don't keep score, and every kid gets a trophy. Yet you mentioned the importance of failure as a great teacher of character. Tell us a little bit more about that.
I think you learn lessons in life from multiple dimensions and directions. And I think that by creating environments where people don't have the chance to learn by their mistakes, and failure perhaps is, you know, an emphasis in that regard, but for young people. But, of course, as time goes by and you mature and you get into the business world, there is failure. By the way, there's another point I want to make. I think people can be of a great integrity, that have great character and be successful in their lives, but that doesn't mean that they're going to be necessarily all that successful in business, because business decisions, you can make a bad decision and be an honest person of great integrity. So I want to make sure I don't link those two necessarily.
Otherwise, we'd all be rich.
Yeah. All those good guys, right? Anyway, I wanted to make sure I made that point. But I think that recognizing that you can learn from your mistakes is a very important thing, and I think very valuable.
What would you say was the biggest mistake you ever made?
Oh, my. Where do we begin? I've made a number of them. I think that I didn't probably recognize the importance of leadership early enough in my career. This is something that's evolved for me. And we were talking a little bit earlier about the fact that in your business, you're frequently interacting with government activity and things that are happening. My view tends to be a little longer view. I must say I didn't start out that way. I started out with a very short-term focus on things. If I had it to do over, I think we could have accelerated what we've done in the company by focusing on some of these issues earlier. I don't know if that's my biggest mistake, but it's certainly one. I've made some others. Maybe I won't talk about them.
So for people entering the federal world, whether it's an industry or in an agency, how can they get a leg up and learn from some of your mistakes and your lessons and not have to repeat them?
I'm tempted to say you can read my book. I had one chap that sent me a note not too long ago and said, Jack, you put a lot of your business secrets in the book. And my response was, I don't know if they're secrets. I don't think they are. But perhaps I've focused on some things that that people will find of value. But I would just say to you that people coming into the industry, coming into this market space, think that I don't know how you can – there's no downside to me by exhibiting the right kinds of accountability and integrity issues that we've been speaking about here. There's no downside. In fact, there's only upside. In fact, I believe that's how you achieve really a personal and professional success, and how you achieve and how you go about these things. By the way, when I talk about success, I'm not talking about wealth, fame, power, rank. I'm talking about how you've lived your life. At the end of the day, being able to look at that mirror and say, hey, I've done the best by this. I've appreciated the people I've worked with. I've done my best, and here we are. I think that's so important.
And so you put a lot of emphasis on, I mean, the subtitle of The Ultimate Success Factor, character will determine how far you go and how far you succeed. And you also say that you are the cap of your own ship. You say who you are is up to you.
Yeah.
And so that doesn't leave people a lot of wiggle room, does it?
No, I think that's very important. And my humble opinion is the sooner one really comes to grips with that, the better, the more enhanced their potential for success in their life and feeling successful in what they've been able to accomplish. The real issue is, if you don't like where you are, you could change that.
You've been listening to a special Federal Drive discussion. We want to thank our guest, Jack London, chairman of the board of CACI International and author of the new book, Character, The Ultimate Success Factor. Jack, it has been just a pleasure having you.
Thank you, Tom. Emily, it's been a pleasure to be with you. I think that the topic here today is one that has a lot of value for all of us, and I would encourage people to think a little bit about what this really amounts to.
And we'll post this interview at federalnewsradio.com. I'm Tom Temin.
I'm Emily Kopp, and listen to The Federal Drive here on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.